Hi, I'm Brian Cohen.
And I'm H. Claire Taylor. Have you struggled to keep up with the fast-changing world of self-publishing?
Do you want to learn the latest news, tips, and tactics to help you sell more books now and into the future?
Welcome to the Sell More Books Show, a weekly podcast that gives you all the info you need to know in under an hour.
To save you time, give you motivation, and boost your publishing profit.
Enough waffling. Let's get started.
Okay, Claire, on with the show.
Welcome to another episode of the Sell More Books Show. This is episode 349. We have made it almost to the end of my first year on the show. This has been really fun. And to celebrate, Brian is not here. So in lieu of Brian, my name is H. Claire Taylor, and we have a guest host today, Julie Strauss. I'm very excited to have Julie on the show. She is an indie author and an editor, a wonderful editor. And she hosts the Best Book Ever podcast, which is super fun. She's an all-around book nerd, and I am so glad to have her on the show. Julie, welcome.
Thank you, Claire. I'm so glad to be here on your almost anniversary. I didn't know I was your designated party pal. That makes this even more fun.
Yeah, we got a few more episodes, and then I hit that 52 mark, which means
awesome.
Brian hasn't kicked me off yet. So. Whew, add that to my CV for when I do off and need to find a new podcast.
The day's early. Let's see how this episode goes. And
that is true. That is true. I need some wood to knock on. So how are you doing today, Julie?
I'm doing great today. I'm just coming off of still a little hungover mentally from the Romance Author Mastermind, which normally happens in Houston. It's hosted by Sky Warren. And this year, of course, it was virtual, but it was still brilliant and excellent. They absolutely nailed the virtual format. So I'm not going to go as far as to say it was as good as being in person, because of course it wasn't. You know, you want to sit down and have lunch with people you don't get to see all that often. But as far as virtual conferences went, this was far and away the best one I've been to. And without a doubt, this is probably the best conference that I go to, because these people are brilliant.
And it sounds like they're generous from what I've heard.
Yes, they are so generous. It's really big time, very successful authors, and they show up and they talk about, this is exactly what I did. And they show their numbers and they say, this step led to this increase in my income, and this step caused this decrease in my income, so that you can really assess their work and figure out if it's a step you want to take. It's really a fantastic conference. I highly recommend it.
Great. Yeah, that sounds good. It's nice to go and just be like a little bit overloaded and then have to process it. We have some time to process lately.
I have plenty of time to think about it. And this is the first time in a really long time I have felt very enthused about writing again, which is a great feeling. Just being around people who are enthused and are still working very hard, which I have not written a lot this year. And this conference made me really want to dive in again, which is fantastic.
Yeah, that is the conference boost that I forget about how useful that is until I get it. And it's good to know that you can still get it from online conferences, right? That you can get charged up. It's just a matter of saying, okay, I'm going to do this.
Right.
Well, that is awesome. I have been a little bit slow this week. I don't know. I'm like kind of, so I have my quarter four break coming up in a couple weeks. And I feel like, you know, when you're, maybe people don't do this anymore. Maybe successful people don't do this. But when you just don't fill up your car with gas, you know that you're pushing that red light, the gas light. And you just kind of like, you're like, I could probably like glide into the gas station. That's kind of where I am at this point. I feel like I'm just gliding. Uh-huh. And I'm sure that I have enough momentum to get me to the gas, but I sure am out of gas. So that's where I've kind of been this week. So I'm taking it easy on myself, but that's just for writing. I do have the 5-Star Power Endings Masterclass coming up this Saturday, which I am very charged up about. So this is something that I, you know, I'm doing for anyone who bought a package through the webinar that I did with Brian recently, automatically has a ticket. There are also tickets for sale. If you go to ffs.media/5-star, that's FIVE STAR-endings, or you can just follow me on Facebook and I'll post something about it on my FFS Media web Facebook page. So I'm gearing up for that. That's really fun. This is like one of my favorite things to talk about is just endings. It's also my favorite thing to rant about is bad endings, right? So I will be showing people how to make it all come together for some fun. If anyone wants to sign up for that, there are some seats available still. So go check it out. Let's dive into it, shall we, Julie?
Let's do it.
So the winner of Brian's Sizzling Synopsis book and my coming soon TBA nonfiction book on the Indie Author Alignment is Dave Kaur. All right, Dave Kaur, email Brian and then just be sure to email me whenever I actually do publish this book. It will be next year. It will be in January or February, not this year. So you can take a load off. You can still email me if you want, Dave Kaur. You're still my favorite music genre, Dave Kaur. Let's go in to our patrons, our featured patrons. And if you want to be a featured patron, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/SMBS. So our first patron is Craig Anderson. He writes, "Level up. Virtual is reality. What would the world be like if video game rules suddenly applied? Marcus is about to find out. After a freak accident, he finds himself stuck between a game and the real world. He'll need to fight his way through football hooligans, carnies, and the dreaded RNG to get to the final boss and save the world. Anything less means it's game over for good." And that's Level Up by Craig Anderson.
Next is Anne-Marie Uber with 60 Second Tarot. Does the thought of learning tarot feel overwhelming? 60 Second Tarot is the easy-to-use handbook for restoring peace and harmony in your life. If you like simple, new-age solutions, practical advice from trusted experts, and measurable results, then you will love Anne-Marie Uber's empowering guide to harnessing your future by learning to read the tarot.
I really think that the subtitle for that should be Wands in 60 Seconds. And it should just be about stealing cars. It's not. Go check out 60 Second Tarot. And then
that's a great idea.
The Tilt by M.A. Robbins. Can a man with no hope save the world from utter annihilation? The Tilt is the first book in the Tilt post-apocalyptic thriller series. If you like lone wolf Avengers, gritty gunfights, and breakneck action, then you'll love M.A. Robbins' explosive novel of fast-paced apocalyptic violence.
Who doesn't love those?
Yeah. Okay, so now we will go into the question of the week. So last week's question of the week, do you stick to one plotting/outlining technique, or do you find it easier to overlay or synthesize multiple ones? So Brock T.I. Penner said, quote, "I use Anatomy of Story by John Truby as the base with extra beats from Save the Cat Writes a Novel by Jessica Brody in there as well. For future novels, I'm going to use the thematic positive-negative structure from Story by Robert McKee."
And Timothy Fagan said, "I try to follow a plotting technique that I've developed over the years, although occasionally inspiration strikes while writing that throws off my outline plan. Darn inspiration. Shakes fist." And I hope Timothy immediately apologized to his inspiration, because we love inspiration. We're not really shaking our fists.
Yeah, we're more waving hello. Maybe yes. Motioning for it to come over.
Correct.
Come here. Luring it. We're luring inspiration.
Right. We got to be careful of our karma, Timothy.
And then Eustacia Tan said, quote, "I can't plot for some reason, but I'm using a combination of Claire's SYS and the inside outline from Jenny Nash in Revision, and I'm liking it so far. Claire's SYS/Enneagram system helps me to nail down the characters. Inside outline helps with plot." That's the point of my system. The SYS, of course, being Supercharger Story, is that I want people to understand the characters so that the plotting just kind of flows naturally. If you understand the energy of the people driving the story, in my opinion, plotting becomes a little bit less tricky and a little bit less important, because you know, I need to up this energy. I need to advance this growth of this character, the pressure, the squeeze I'm putting on this character. But these are all really great plotting techniques. I'm not surprised to see Save the Cat, Anatomy of Story, So yeah, it looks like everybody's doing their own thing. What about you, Julie? How do you plot?
I'm the same way. I mix up a lot of things. I like the snowflake method. I like Save the Cat Writes a Novel. For romance, obviously, Romancing the Beat is sort of the gold standard. But I also really like talking it out. And I've done coaching calls with you, and I've done coaching calls with Ara and Janice over at Novel Intensive. And sometimes I think the talk through with a trusted and wiser person is really, really, really important.
Yes. I think when people get stuck, they don't want to look to someone else because they feel like they should be able to do this. They should just be able to look at it and look at the, you know, go back to these books that we revisit about plotting and figure it out. Mm-hmm. But it just doesn't have to be that hard. I mean, most of the time when I talk to people who are actually stuck, rather than like, I just haven't thought it through, but like stuck, all the pieces are there, right? So it's not like a failing. It's just like something just is not clicking yet, but you've put all of the pieces that you need into this somehow. So yeah, I mean, that's just one of those little things where it's like, it's not a failing. Everybody can use some help.
Well, and I think it's one of those classic situations where we know the stories in our head as the writer. So we assume that we have gotten the story out. And I think we forget sometimes that our readers don't know the entire history of this character the way we do. And they will sometimes say, why did she need to kill that person? I don't get this. This came out of left field. As soon as you say out loud, oh, well, he abused her and this happened, then you have the answer. And they go, well, you never told me that. So as soon as you talk it out, you realize that there are things in your head that you haven't actually put in your manuscript. I think it's a really important step so that you can find the holes.
It is. It is. And I mean, I know that I have to do that too for my story. Even though I do that, you know, consulting professionally, I usually turn to my husband. We'll go walk the dogs and I'll go, okay, so here's the deal. Here's where I'm stuck. And talking it out with him and getting his, you know, feedback, especially when I'm writing cop books, he's obviously very useful for that. Yeah, sure. That is just, it's like such a weight off your shoulders, isn't it?
Yes, it really is. You just realize you're missing this one piece of information and the whole thing unlocks.
Totally. Totally. All right. Well, shall we go into the tips of the week?
Let's do it.
I'm going to let you go first on these.
And now on the Sell More Books Show, it's the tip of the week.
I hate waiting. You have a book getting ready to launch, and it's tempting to put up a pre-order. But before you do, consider whether that will work for you or against you. Quote, if it's your first book and you have no real platform, I would skip the pre-order, says Penny Sanseveri, writing for janefriedman.com. A pre-order is a great tool if you're ready to hit the ground running when your book launches. But if it takes months to get reviews, it will hurt your exposure on Amazon. Unquote. If you've already built up a catalog and a mailing list, the pre-orders can work, but still, most of your marketing should be reserved for when the book is available. Unless you're a mega bestseller, it's not easy to drive significant numbers to your pre-order page, says Sanseveri, and if a reader wants something now, they may not want to wait for your book to be ready and could end up buying something else instead.
Whew, this is one of those, isn't it? I feel like every release, I have to consider this. Every new book, I'm like, am I going to do a pre-order? What are the pros? What are the cons? You know, it depends on, there's so many variables. It depends on if you're wide, if you're in KU, your audience. What did you think reading this? Did you get a little anxiety?
No, not anxiety specifically. What I had to tell myself was that this was specifically geared to people who are looking to build up a following on Amazon and to hit big sales on Amazon. I think it's really important to remember that the other platforms do not punish you for a lack of pre-order success the way Amazon does. So that's the first thing to remember. The other thing I think that's really important to remember is that for a lot of new, I'm talking brand new authors who don't have a book out, that first step is terrifying. And seeing your name, even your pen name, and sometimes your picture up on Amazon is very anxiety-inducing. And putting the pre-order up can be a really good way, if you're nervous, to just get started, to just sort of dip your toe into the pool and get used to the idea that you are up there. So I would say if you're a first timer and you don't have following anyway, it's not going to hurt, most likely. And you can get used to saying, I have a book on Amazon. It is up for pre-order if you're interested. That's a hard thing for a lot of us to get used to. So for real newbies, I don't think it hurts, honestly.
That's such a great point. It is hard. I mean, sometimes I also see it as like, sometimes you need that external accountability for a very long time, not since COVID, because Amazon is like, you want to take it off pre-order? Go ahead. No big deal. But prior right. to that, once you put it up for pre-order, you're like, I got to hit this date or else they're going to, you know, keep me from doing pre-orders for a year. May or may not matter, but it's still, it feels bad to be penalized. So yeah, it was kind of that external accountability. And some people do need that. I don't do well with it, actually. I had a book up for pre-order, I think it was for April of this year. And it was this detective novel I've been working on. And I was like, if I just put it up there, like, I'm going to get it done. Because I started working on it in, oh gosh, August of 2019. And so it's been over a year and I'm still not ready with it. Keeps giving me problems. But I was like, yes, I will do it. This will work for me. And then I was like, wait, so we can just like cancel these pre-orders, no penalty? And that's what I did. There are all kinds of reasons to consider it. And as to your point of, you know, the other sales channels not penalizing for if you don't sell a lot in your pre-order. Not only that, but they actually reward you pretty well for pre-order. Mm-hmm. So it's right. There's only bonuses for pre-orders if you're wide.
Right. I think this is a really numbers on Amazon focused article, which is fine. If that's your goal is to hit Amazon hard on your very first day, then I think you really do want to take these into account. But it's definitely not the whole picture, particularly for brand new authors for this one, I think.
Yeah. It always goes back to what is your goal? What is your strategy? Mm-hmm. And what tactics work for it? All right. So I'll jump into the next one. We've got ready, set, launch. How do you build a book launch team? In 5 steps, says author Sarah Gribble on The Right Practice. 1, ask everyone. While some writers prefer smaller teams, remember that you're looking for the most word of mouth possible. So Gribble recommends asking everyone. Quote, ask on social media, ask your email list, and ask your friends and family. Get in touch with people personally, end quote. 2, be clear about your goals with your team. Write them down and give it to them. 3, give them each a free copy before the launch and encourage reviews on release day. 4, keep them engaged with swag, giveaways, and games in a private group. 5, no matter what happens, reward them after your launch. Quote, being part of a launch team is a volunteer situation. Every person is doing you a favor. Never forget that. Some of this is probably, you know, a reminder for people. Anything in here that stood out to you, Julie?
What I really liked about this was setting up the rules in advance and setting up your boundaries in advance. Because I will tell you, when authors reach the point where they start talking about hiring a PA, the first thing every one of them says is, I just want someone to handle my advanced reader team. Because we all kind of want reviews and we kind of fling our books around willy-nilly and it becomes unmanageable because we haven't set up the rules. And that's what's so great about having PAs to enforce the rules. And so if I were to go back and start over again, I would start off with a clear set of rules right off the bat.
Yeah. Yeah. It is just a lot of customer service running this. Mm-hmm. It turns into a lot of customer service where people are, you know, not sure how to show you that they left reviews or not sure how to find those links, or they send you the reviews and you're like, like, this is great, but you need to put that on Amazon. You know, mm-hmm. It does turn into a whole thing. And the clear rules are great. And this part, encourage reviews on release day. That is, so for those sort of early on in this game or who haven't put together a reader team, it's very important that you make it clear that they're under no obligation to leave you reviews. You would really appreciate it and kind of fall back onto the natural human impulse for reciprocation since you gave them a free book, but you can't say in exchange for, because that is no good. That is, it can't be quid pro quo, as it were. Mm-hmm. So that's an important thing to look into.
But I would say along those lines that, you know, she ends here with every person is doing you a favor. Never forget that. I do think it's very important to keep an eye on that list. Not all of them are doing you favors. And it took me way too long to notice. I had people on my review team who had gotten 10 of my books and never left a single review. You know, that goes back to I should have set up some rules for myself right off the bat, but there are freebie seekers out there. So yes, treat them like gold. They are wonderful to have. I adore my review team, adore them. But also I will cut you right away. If you now,
not just cut you.
I haven't come to that yet.
That is a thing. I mean, and I hear a lot of people, and I've experienced it myself, where you realize that you've been giving this person a bunch of your books and they've been leaving you 2- and 3-star reviews. And you're like, why are you even taking these if you don't like them? And mm-hmm. So, I mean, for me, I will reach out or have a VA reach out to that person and be like, hey, I don't know if you're like, it doesn't seem like you're really enjoying this. So like, maybe you don't want to be on the team. Like legitimately, you don't like these books or they're not that good in your opinion, you know? So that is a whole other customer service thing where you,
yeah,
like, I don't like your reviews. You have to go. But it's also like, I think it would benefit both of us if you just stopped reading the series.
We would both be happier. Yeah. Yeah. I've never actually cut anybody for a bad review, but I just have recently started cutting people for just not reviewing because they're just taking my books. That's right. My work.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a different thing if you're like, okay, I'm going to put this book on permafree, but it's like, it's a new release. Mm-hmm. They get buzz and they're just taking like, no, thanks.
Right.
I'm with you on that. And that is where all of the customer service stuff gets really tricky because I have to mm-hmm. go to the side and like rant in my outdoor voice indoors to my husband before I can sit down and be like, I totally get it. This is, yeah. Thank you for letting me know. It's like, okay, blow off some of that steam. All right. So let's move on to the next tip. You're up, Julie.
There's an app for that. While apps can get a bad rap for sucking away our writing time, many can save us more time than they waste, especially when it comes to social media. Frances Caballo on Social Media Just for Writers gives us her list of her favorite time-saving apps, starting with Later, a scheduling app for Instagram. Quote, I love Later because I can get a visual sense of my scheduled images for the week or the month, unquote. If you're looking to make your selfies look better and save time doing it, look to Lensa. Want your ideal hashtags without spending all day digging? Try allhashtag.com. With the way social media is going visual, it pays to have a good graphics app such as Canva. I have the professional version, which enables me to convert images to different sizes quickly and without any effort, says Caballo. I've used Canva for years now, and I haven't found a substitute that I like better. What apps do you use, Claire?
None.
None?
I like
you don't do any of those?
I like to make social media as unpleasant as possible.
No,
I
mean, really?
I have used Canva and my assistant used Canva a lot when I had her doing graphic stuff, but I have Photoshop and I'm pretty good at it. So I usually just use Photoshop. Mm. I have my templates set up and everything, but I know that you do a lot of Instagram for best book ever. Do you use mm-hmm. any of this stuff?
I do. I use Canva for the graphics, which I'm not good at graphic design. And this is not an endorsement of any of these, by the way. Canva does, I do enjoy working with Canva and I love Later. I think the pre-scheduling social media post apps are just the best thing ever invented because they really do. I sit down maybe once a week and schedule out and then I'm just done. And I love that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and you have those cute posts that are like quotes from your guests, but yeah. So you do the quotes, you do the little pictures, mm-hmm. you get fancy. I'm like super impressed by your Instagram game. Have you ever used all hashtag?
I've not. I'm going to look into that. That was an interesting one. I've never heard of that before.
Yeah.
But I sort of wing it with hashtags and I don't know. I feel a little bit like a boomer trying to get into the kids' new TikTok. Like, do you think this hashtag will work? I don't know. I'm just trying. So some professional guidance might not be a bad idea there.
Will you explain why you decided to do Instagram for this promotion and not like any other social media? Yeah, for your podcast.
Because I hate all other social media.
Hey, that is a good answer. Now let's move into the top five news of the week.
It's time for the Sell More Books Show top five news. Number five.
Serendipity Now. Barnes & Noble is putting book choice in the hands of the stores for the first time, reports Jeffrey Trachtenberg of the Wall Street Journal. A year ago, store manager John Radford had little control over the books he manages in Idaho Falls, Idaho. Executives in New York decided which titles all stores carried. Radford's store had to stock Patterson and Grisham books despite the lack of local demand, often returning half the inventory, but no more. These days, he's calling the shots after CEO James Daunt fired nearly half the company's New York-based book buyers, powerful tastemakers who decided which titles stores should carry. The very survival of bookstores is on the line, says Daunt. Quote, I don't think we have a God-given right to exist, he told industry professionals. In order to survive, he says, bookstores need to be places to discover books with an enjoyment, with a pleasure, with a serendipity that is simply impossible to replicate online.
So I know you love you some indie bookstores. This kind mm-hmm. of like it's letting Barnes & Noble function a little bit more like an indie bookstore, doesn't it?
Yes, this thrills me. And as much as I love indie bookstores, I also love a Barnes & Noble. I love them. I think they're a wonderful place to spend an afternoon. And I want them to survive. I really, truly do. And if this is the way to do it, it's fantastic to give a community more control over their own bookstore and let it have the personality of the community it primarily serves is such a good idea.
Absolutely. And as someone who has worked at a Barnes & Noble, I can tell you the people there, the people on the floor getting paid, not the big bucks, not in the season, mm-hmm. but on the floor who are looking at the books every day that people want, they know what people are looking for. If I mm-hmm. had my way, we would have had Hank the Cow Dog front and center in the children's department, but maybe not everywhere in the country has such a high demand for Hank the Cow Dog as Texas does. But right. it really is so smart, and it's such a good time to be pivoting because mm-hmm. Barnes & Noble can't beat Amazon at its own game, at its algorithm game or whatever. It really, that human touch is so important. And I just love that they're really talking about the, because Barnes & Noble didn't have this competition, right? When I worked there back in, was it 2008 or, seven or eight or something like that? There was no Amazon books competing with it. And it was the place to go. I mean, Barnes & Noble was on the way to, they were taking borders out at the ankles, they were doing all kinds of stuff. They're on their way to the big time. And now it's like, we're all like, come on, Barnes & Noble, we need you to keep existing. So it's just, it's really nice to see someone come in and have this. I really like this attitude of we don't have a God-given right to exist. I think that's a great business attitude. So I'm hopeful when I read this.
And I may be wrong, but this is my understanding. This is how Costco's work, right? That they're, it's a big box store in every community, but my understanding is that what's offered in my Costco is not the same as what's offered in your Costco, because I don't know, I'm probably going to give a stereotypical reference, but I don't know, maybe Texas doesn't want almond milk the way Southern California does. And so we've got tons of almond milk in my Costco, and I don't know, what does yours have? Maybe more brisket or something.
I don't know.
But maybe.
I don't have a but it's my membership, but this sounds about right.
It's my understanding that they are able to function as a giant corporation, but also serve the individual community. And I think that's really the key. And it makes them more appealing to an outsider as well. When I go to another city and go to their bookstores, I want to see something that's interesting to that community. I don't want to see the exact same bookstore I have at home. That's not interesting.
Right.
So I love this. Yeah. Go Barnes & Noble.
I'm excited about this. I think this kind of thing is what's going to save them. And I can't wait until I can just safely walk right back into a Barnes & Noble, because I love it. There's nothing like the bookstore. Like libraries, they have their own appeal. I understand everyone touching everything all the time kind of grosses me out, but I know that it's very special to a lot of people and it's a valuable part of our infrastructure. But Barnes & Noble, it's just, you go in, you smell the fresh books, you smell a little coffee, a little Starbucks, and you're just, oh, it's so good.
I can't wait.
That's our good news of the week. It's all going downhill from here.
Number four.
A legend has fallen. The annual book convention known as Book Expo is coming to an end, reports Hillel Italy of the Washington Post. Book Expo was once the primary venue for publishers to place orders with booksellers, the host meet and greet with authors, store officials, librarians, and journalists. But over the past few years, attendance fell, leaving much of the convention center empty. This year, the event went virtual, but the status for next year's show was already in doubt. Quote, the pandemic arrived at a time where we were already examining how to restructure our events to best meet the community's need, said Book Expo event director Jennifer Martin. Quote, this has led us to a difficult decision to retire the events in their current formats, says Martin. We remain committed to serving the book community and look forward to sharing more information in the future. How do you feel about this?
This is one of those stories that's just like everything in our current digital and post-pandemic world. You know, this news is a real bummer for people who are used to networking at prestigious book events. And I get that. I've always wanted to go to Book Expo. So it is a bummer. But it's a boon for, you know, upstarts who aren't afraid of digital communication, aren't afraid of digital distribution. This just gives them more access to the publishing world if we're moving these events online. So, you know, I think this is one of those things. It's a drag. I also think this is the way it's going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you really can't stop the forward march of progress, or, you know, the one step back as it right. was pandemic. But yeah, I mean, this is interesting. I think it opens up a lot of opportunities, like you said, for other people to step in, for smaller groups. I really think that we have to get to the point where we're having smaller, more intimate, you know, gatherings. Especially when you have stuff like last week's story about Penguin Random House trying to buy Simon and Schuster. You know, I think just it creates an opportunity for a next tier of collaborations to come in, and we'll see how it goes. I mean, you know, another one bites the dust.
Yeah.
Number three.
Under pressure. A new petition calls for an antitrust investigation against Amazon for its ban on selling its imprints, ebooks, to libraries. Ultimately, if you can't find an ebook at a library, where are you going to buy it? On your Kindle, says Fight for the Future activist Leah Holland. Amazon's refusal to sell its ebooks published in-house to libraries is sparking backlash by librarians and activists as demand for digital content spikes during the coronavirus pandemic. Those pushing argue Amazon's self-imposed ban significantly decreases public access to information. You shouldn't have to have a credit card in order to be an informed citizen, says Michael Blackwell, director of St. Mary's County Library in Maryland. It's vital that books continue to be a source of information and that those books should be democratically discovered through libraries. Amazon does say it is in discussions to allow its ebooks to be licensed by libraries, but so far, libraries are unable to access Amazon's digital titles.
Now, when I saw that this was a story that had to do with Amazon and libraries, I thought, Lee Strauss is not going to have any opinion on this.
No, I'm pretty neutral on this one.
What do you got for us?
Most of what I have for you on this cannot be repeated on a family show. But let me start by saying, I am hopeful for that final sentence where they say they are in negotiations and they're going to try. And let's just all hope that's true. I think the salient point to remember here is that we always have to remember who we are in bed with when we are dealing with Amazon. And Amazon does not care about readers or writers or books. Amazon cares about dollars. And anyone who tries to pretend that this is a company that is encouraging reading, that is untrue. That is a lie. This decision to not let their imprint ebooks go to libraries helps no one except them. It doesn't, it hurts readers, it hurts writers, it hurts the publishing industry, it hurts libraries. And by hurting libraries, you're hurting a community. They are actually doing damage, I think. And I have a very high opinion of the role of libraries. So I genuinely think they do damage to a society with this decision. Needless to say, this news makes me very, very angry. Now, I'm not trying to be self-righteous or on a high horse here. I have a couple of books in KU. I buy stuff from Amazon all the time. We're a high-risk family in a pandemic. Amazon has a ton of my money. So I'm not trying to pretend like I'm this hippie lady over here who, you know, makes her own books with pen and ink. And, you know, I'm not. I rely on Amazon. But I just think we always, always have to remember who they are and what they stand for when it comes to books, because they do not stand for reading or the publishing industry. They stand for dollar bills.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's a very valid point, is that if you are an indie author, you are a business owner. And so it's really important to get clear on where everyone's interests lie. I think there might be some indies out there who don't like the idea of their ebooks going to a library because it could cut down on their income, right? So maybe that's the counter argument here. I'm trying to come up with counter arguments. Really dredging up some stuff here. But and at the same time, it does produce opportunity for places wide distribution that allows library checkouts, right? Kobo, it's very easy to get your books into libraries through Kobo, through, I don't know who else does it. Kobo, Draft to Digital. Now.
Draft to Digital. Uh-huh.
So it kind of creates opportunities for other places for people, you know, when indie authors do want to get their books into libraries.
Right. But these are Amazon imprints. So if you have published a book through an Amazon imprint, you don't have that option, right?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, there are a lot under the Amazon imprints.
And I understand what you're saying, that some indies might, although I guess you're technically not an indie if you're publishing through an Amazon imprint, but some authors might not want their books to have that kind of library access. And that's a personal decision. But then it should be that author's decision. It shouldn't be Amazon saying, and also none of your books are going into libraries. That's where it really sticks with me, is then I don't have a choice as a reader or as a writer. I don't have any say in that matter. And that's just not fair.
Yes. Listen, Julie, I agree with you on this. I'm like, get everything into the library. I love this quote that says, you shouldn't have to have a credit card in order to be an informant. Mm-hmm. I think that just about sums it up. Because you can't pay with cash on Amazon, and not everyone should have to have a credit card to be able to learn and be part of the society. So that's...
And particularly in a time that we are in, with these record levels of unemployment and this financial crisis that is about to get worse, it just seems like they are once again missing a tremendous opportunity to create goodwill. What if they said everything is going into every library because these are hard times and we want you to still have a book to read? Can you imagine the great publicity they would garner off that single move? It would be incredible if they were to say, when things are hard, we're better to you. We are kinder to you. We're giving you more. But once again, they don't serve us as readers. Mm-hmm. They serve the dollar bill. That's it.
Yeah. I wonder if indies would be okay with that, honestly, if suddenly they were, all their books were available in libraries and they hadn't planned for it. I don't know. I mean, what are the rates going to be worse than Kindle Unlimited page reads? I don't know.
Right.
You know, so I think it would depend on the pricing model. Or you could just have your book in Audible and basically be part of a library system you don't get paid for anyway. Okay, moving on. I like this next story. So I'm excited about this one. So let's jump into number two.
Number two.
Survey says, the latest author study by Written Word Media is in, and this year looks at the behaviors of authors in five different stages of income, ranging from $0 to $249 per month at stage one, and over $10,000 per month for stage five. The survey covers the number of books published, hours spent writing, and how much authors tend to spend on various aspects of book creation. Notable are the numbers of books written, which averages 42 for authors earning over $10,000 a month, while the number of hours spent writing didn't increase much past stage one. Quote, what the stages do illustrate, says Written Word's Clayton Noblet, is some general changes in focus and investment over time. As authors earn more, they begin to invest more in editing and cover design, end quote. On a positive note, the authors who don't love marketing should take note this tends to be a part-time activity for authors across every stage. Quote, you don't need to put in 40 hours a week to see success. As authors gain skills, they are working smarter, not harder. That is good, right? There is sort of that threshold past which the amount of marketing you do is just that time is better spent on creating more books.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So what are some of the trends that you picked up from this, Julie?
I actually really enjoyed reading through this. I thought this was so interesting and bared out a lot of suspicions that I had, mainly being that the two things that I was really interested in was that this notion that we have of an immediate success is absolutely false. I know we all know people who are successful with book one, but for the majority of us, putting out more books and diversifying, that was the other thing that really struck me, was the stage five people, the highest earners, have a lot in audio. So diversifying your platform is really, really important. And the other thing, of course, as an editor that I found very interesting was the point at which you start spending more money on editing is, well, which one's cause and which one's result, you know, but the higher earners do tend to spend more in editing.
Right. Yeah, that is a good question. Like, is it, you know, is it causation or correlation?
That,
you know, is it that you need to start getting your books edited better before you'll start making those next levels of money? Or is it that you start making those levels of money, you go, oh, okay, thank God, now I can get these edited.
Right.
Yeah, I think that probably depends a lot on the person. To mm-hmm. personality. I mean, for me, it's like, I want to be able to get as good of editing as possible. Why I hire you. And So, yeah, I mean, I think this is really great. I was thrilled with the threshold of marketing because nobody wants to do more than 20 hours of marketing a week.
Yes.
It's such a small percentage of the community that got into this because they're like, I am a marketer and I can figure out how to write books and make money. Right. Mm-hmm. It's really the other way. There are those people for sure. And great. I admire those people's, you know, skills in marketing. It's awesome. But for the most part, people want to write books and they're like, I should probably figure out how to sell these. And so going from that direction, it's like, you don't want to be full-time marketing. And you get to a point, I mean, at least I get to a point at about 15 to 20 hours a week where I'm like, duh, what do I do next? Like, I don't know what other marketing there is to do. You know, I guess I could learn Facebook ads, which I have not done and should do, but it's kind of like, okay, I can just write the next book. Like, I think this shows that wisdom does bear out of, you know, just write the next book. It's the best marketing you can do.
And the other thing I really liked was that the highest tier of earners are also not, they're not only not marketing significantly more hours than we are, they are not writing 24 hours a day either. It really is about managing time correctly because as indie business owners, it is so tempting to say, well, I've finished everything that I had scheduled to do for the day, but you know, it's only 6 o'clock. I could probably work till midnight. So I'm going to do more because why not? You know, my office is here in my home. I can keep working. And we have this sort of ethos that more hours equals more money. And these results it just doesn't bear out that way.
Absolutely. Oh man. I mean, it takes some drastic moments, I think, for a lot of people, myself included, to get that point. Because we want to think, it's that need for control of, if I'm not making the money I want, it's because I'm not working hard enough. Therefore, like, yes, it's my failure, but it could also be my success. Like, I could change something about this, like, easily this week, right? If I just worked harder this week, then maybe I'd make more money this week. But it's been the months that I took 2 weeks off or just didn't work that hard that I made the most money and went, oh no, is this a myth that I've been holding on to?
Your entire self-identity went down the toilet then, huh?
Maybe I should just never work and make all the money. That's also not how it goes. But yeah, so you're right that from stage two or three to stage five in these, it sounds like it's stage five is some sort of terminal indie state. Sorry, you're going to be an indie for the rest of your life. You've published too many things that will never get you hired anywhere. Like from stage three to stage five, there's really not that much difference in behavior other than time.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, you mean the longer you're in a business, the more success you're likely to have? Yeah, that makes sense. You know, the longer you've been doing this. Although the virtual assistant was one difference that I was like, yes. That's so hard though, to go from I'm doing all the things to, okay, now I'm going to pay someone to do things for me. And I'm going to suddenly feel like I'm not doing enough. And I'm going to need to make more money because I have to pay this person, right? That is, so many people get hung up on that step.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But once you get past it, smooth sailing, nothing wrong will ever happen again in your career.
Everything is easy for the rest of your life.
Yeah, it's happily ever after. Okay, shall we go into the top story of the week? What do you think, Julie?
Let's go.
Now the number one top five news item.
AI for everyone. Joanna Penn's been predicting it for years, but Google's finally making the bold leap into machine-generated audiobooks, says Lars Hedbor in a tip emailed to the show. Thank you, Lars. Google is now working on auto-generated narrators that can turn more books into audiobooks, reports Abner Lee on 9to5google.com. The new feature is intended to make more audio titles available in audio on the Google Store. Says Google, not all books, like the one written by your favorite indie author, are converted into an audiobook. Google's solution is to automate the process, working with US and UK publishing houses that own the rights to the books. They specifically mention the benefits to readers of indie books, says Hedbor, whose authors often cannot afford the cost of having an audiobook produced. The new AI publisher tool is currently in beta and will be available to all publishers early next year. Claire, what do you think of this?
I am a little bit of two minds because I think there are going to be a lot of authors who can take advantage of this and it will serve them just fine. And it will create that accessibility for readers who do have something like vision impairment, and open them up without having to spend a bunch of money, right? There's going to be a lot of people who are going to go, oh, cool. Yeah, I might as well do this, right? I mean, assuming that Google doesn't own any of the rights at that point, then you can just take it off and, you know, take it down and have someone else produce it later, you know, have a voice actor, a human, as they, as they call us. So I think it might be a good stopgap. But on the other hand, as a listener of audiobooks, I would probably never listen to one of these because people who love audiobooks love the performance. It's not just they're not really narrating, you know, it's not a narrator, it's a voice actor. And all of my favorite books, you know, I have stopped reading series because I started them on audiobook and they changed narrators. And I thought, no, this series is dead to me. I'm very picky about this because it's in my head, right? This voice is in my head. I don't necessarily want... You and I both are big fans of Inspector Gamache and those audiobooks, or the Chief Inspector Gamache series. Mm-hmm. Those audiobooks are so good. But I just got to the point in the series where the audiobook narrator, like, he died. R.I.P.
Oh, no.
I had to switch to a new narrator. And the only reason I'm sticking with it is because the narrator died and he can't help that. Nobody can help. So I'm giving the next narrator a shot, but otherwise we would be done. that's kind of how I feel about it. It might work if you can get some sales out of it in the meantime. I don't think this is going to be an actual replacement for like trained voice talent. But what do you think?
Gosh, I don't know. And I think I'm middle-aged enough that this kind of information makes my skin crawl. But I'm also young enough to kind of go, well, it's probably going to happen. And we are probably all going to adapt to it. I hope we don't, because I'm the same way. I have books where I actually don't like the books that much, but I love, there is a series who I will not name, but there is a series where the books are okay, but she has the same audio narrator for every book who is so brilliant that I pick up every single one of her books. Every single time a new book comes out, I listen to it because the telling of the story is so brilliant. I don't know how we will ever get that through AI, but that's what we thought with every single new technology is, how will it ever be as good as this thing that came before? And we'll be proven wrong, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, I have found some different, like, you know, text-to-speech, like, places, like, websites and stuff where you can pick the different voices. They all have human names. So you can, like, pick the different ones. Some of them are very realistic in tone. They're getting much better. I just don't know that... I just think it's going to be a while. I won't say it'll never happen, but I think it's going to be a while before they can really tap into the sort of art of writing and pick up on the subtexts that really good voice actors do.
Yeah, I agree. And I hope it doesn't come to that, but it probably will. But I don't have to participate in that. But, you know, honestly, like you said, I can see the appeal. If you're writing a nonfiction or an instructive book, this might be a great stopgap. This might be a great way for you to get it out to more people where you don't need tremendous emotion baked into the storytelling. And this is a fine answer for you. And, you know, that's great. Then do it. But for those of us who are really invested in storytelling, I'm not nuts about it.
It might be really cool though. Like, what if you wrote a book that was all about AI, like a fiction book about AI that's impersonating humans, and then you have AI narrate it. That's fun, right?
Oh, that is good. Or if you have a book where it's a conflict between, you know, artificial and flesh humans, and then you have one of each narrator reading each part, wouldn't that be good?
That's fun.
Interesting. Like that. You know what? There are some really fun applications to it then. If you really do, if you write those kinds of books, if you're writing that kind of science fiction, I would love to hear the creative ways that sci-fi writers are going to take advantage of that, because that's where it could get very interesting.
You could have AI just read the dialogue of your AI. And split that with the voice. Oh, that would be fun. I mean, that's a lot of editing, but that would be cool. And if you write nonfiction about AI, I will be disappointed if you don't use this technology.
What I want to see happen is if you write fiction about AI and then the AI voice in the middle of the reading says, "Can I just stop you here? An AI would never have said something like that." Do you know anything about the Enneagram for the AI? Clearly you don't.
Yeah, it's just zeros and ones. All right. Well, we need to come up with a question of the week for everyone, you and I. Something that we've talked about today that may hit on a nerve with people. I like to be a little bit jabby.
With a little provocative.
Yeah. Yeah. Get in there. Push some buttons. So what stood out to you today?
You know, I would be interested to know if the Amazon library story is as, if people are reacting to that as strongly as I reacted to that, or is that just me because I'm a library nerd? I don't know. I'd be curious to know what others think about that. That would be one.
So a question like, is Julie overreacting?
Oh my God. Yeah. I can tell you this, my husband's going to hear this episode and his eyes are going to roll so far into the back of his head that he may never have vision again.
Well, he could have AI read him some books.
So. He can have AI read to him. It's perfect.
All right. So we'll make that the question of the week. Insofar as Amazon distributing to libraries, would you, as an indie author publishing on Amazon, be happy if they started distributing, or are there drawbacks to it that would make you hesitate?
That's a great way to ask the question, because I am curious to know what are the benefits of this? What am I missing here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's always good to ask. That's why we like Hive Mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks again for coming on the show. It's been a pleasure, Julie.
The pleasure is all mine, Claire. Thank you so much for inviting me and trusting me with such inflammatory stories that you knew I would lose my mind over.
Thank you again for coming and helping out when Brian is out this week. And thank you to all the listeners who joined us. We hope you enjoyed the show. That is it for this episode, number 349 of the Sell More Book Show. And I hope that you guys have a great week. And I will be back here with Brian Cohen next week for episode 350.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Sell More Book Show. Visit the website at www.sellmorebookshow.com for detailed show notes and subscription information, or to send us news or comments for use on the show. Also, please take a moment to subscribe to the show and leave us a review. Thank you very much for listening, and happy bookselling.